This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Torn Away, written by Jennifer Brown, read by Lauren Fortgang. For Scott and Pranston, you are my home. Maren wanted to teach me the East Coast swing. It was pretty much her only goal in life. She was constantly pulling on my arms or standing in front of the TV, her hands on her square little hips, sparkle nail polish glinting, and ratty rose-colored tutu quivering. "Come on, Jersey, it's fun! You'll like it! Jersey!" Stomp. "Are you listening to me? Jersey!" She'd learned swing in Miss Janice's dance class. Technically, it wasn't a routine they were there to learn, but one evening, Janice, in an old-school mood, had popped in a swing CD and taught them how to do it. Maren thought it was the best dance ever. She was forever counting off, her pudgy 5-year-old arms around an imaginary dance partner, her brown curls bouncing to a beat only she could hear as she hummed what she remembered of the song they'd danced to in class. But she really wanted me to be her dance partner. She probably imagined me grabbing her wrists, pulling her through my legs, tossing her into the air, and then catching her. She probably envisioned the two of us in matching costumes, wowing an audience. "Not now, Maren," I told her time and again, too busy watching TV or doing homework or texting my best friends, Jane and Danny, about what pests little sisters can be. Especially little sisters who think the whole world is about the East Coast swing. Maren lived in leotards. She had sequined ones and velvety ones and some that looked like tuxedos, and plain ones in every color of the rainbow. She wore them until they were so small her butt cheeks hung out, and her tutus sported holes in the netting that she could fit a fist through. Still, Mom had to throw them away when Maren wasn't looking, and had to buy new ones to make up for the favorites that were lost. We'd begun to wonder if Maren would insist on wearing leotards when she started kindergarten in the fall, and what exactly would happen when the teacher said she couldn't. We feared meltdowns, epic morning battles, ultimatums, because Maren wore those dance leotards everywhere. Around the house, to the store, to bed, and, of course, to dance class. She was wearing one on the day of the tornado. It was tangerine-colored, with black velvet panels on the sides, a line of rhinestones dotting the neckline. I knew this because it was what she'd been wearing when she asked me to do the East Coast swing with her before she went to class that day. "I can teach you," she said hopefully, hopping on her toes next to the couch, where I was sprawled back doing nothing but staring at a car commercial. As if I'd ever have money for a car. "No," I said. "Get out of the way, I can't see the TV." She'd glanced over her shoulder at the TV, and I could see where something sticky had adhered a bit of black lint to her cheek. Wisps of curls around her face looked like they'd once been sticky as well. Probably a popsicle. It was the end of May and already warm enough for popsicles. School would be out in less than a week, and I would officially be a senior. She leaned in closer and prodded my shoulder with her fat little fingers. Also sticky. "It's a commercial! Get up, I'll show you!" "No, Maren," I'd groaned, getting annoyed, brushing my shirt off where her fingers had touched. And when she'd commenced to jumping up and down in front of me, repeating, "Please, please, please," I yelled at her. "No, I don't want to! Go away!" She stopped jumping and pouted, sticking out her bottom lip the way little kids do when they're getting ready to cry. She didn't say anything. Didn't cry, didn't throw a fit, just blinked at me, that lower lip trembling, and then walked away, the bling on her leotard catching the light from the TV. I heard her go into Mom's room. I heard them talking. And when they left for dance class, I felt relieved that she was finally out of my hair. I loved Maren. I loved my little sister. but after that day, I would hear myself over and over again. "Go away!" I would shout at her in my dreams. I would see that trembling lip. I would see the slow blink of her big, pixie-like eyes. I would see her walk away, up on her toes the way she always did, the glint of the rhinestones from her leotard blinding me. Chapter 1. The day of the tornado began gray and dreary. One of those days where you don't want to do anything but lounge around and sleep while it mists and drizzles and spits. All of the classrooms looked dark and shadowy and gross, and there was no energy in the building whatsoever. And all of the teachers were practically begging someone, anyone, to answer one of their questions, but when they turned their backs to write on the whiteboard, they were stifling yawns of their own because they felt it too. Spring is like that around Elizabeth, Missouri. One day it's really beautiful and sunny, and the birds outside your window wake you up. They're tweeting so loud, and the next day it's chilly and windy, and you can hear gusts lashing up against the side of your house and buzzing against the blinds of the laundry room window that has never been very airtight. And then the next day it does nothing but rain and drum up earthworms onto the sidewalks, only to shrivel them with the next day's sun and wind. "Welcome to the Midwest," Mom used to say, "where the weather keeps you guessing and you're almost always sure to hate it." We made complaining about the weather a full-time job in Elizabeth. It was the one thing we could count on to blame for our migraines and our blue funks and the reason we overslept and our bad hair days. The unpredictable weather could derail even the best day. When the final bell rang that day, Miss Soper, my language arts teacher, hollered out, "Quiz tomorrow on Bless the Beasts, people. Got some thunderstorms coming in tonight. Perfect reading weather. Hint, hint." And sure enough, when we walked out to the bus, the clouds were pressing in on us, thickening up and making it seem much more like evening than 3:15 in the afternoon. "Soper's quizzes are stupid," Danny said, her hip brushing up against mine as we slid down the bus line. "I've never studied for one, and I always get A's." "Quiz tomorrow, bless the beasts, people, hint, hint," I mimicked because I did a pretty good impression of Miss Soper, and we both laughed. "I already read most of it anyway," I said. I peered over my shoulder. Colby, my neighbor, was several steps behind me, carrying his skateboard as usual. I waved to him, and he waved back. "Where's Jane?" I asked Danny. "Had to stay after for orchestra rehearsal. Better her than me. I've been ready to go home since lunch. I can't imagine having to hang out in this prison for another 3 hours. But you know Jane and her violin. She's happy about it."
"She's going to die with that violin permanently attached to her hand," I added.
Jane was ultra-devoted to her instrument, and Danny and I mercilessly teased her about it. But we both knew that without Jane, our trio would never be complete. She was musical and scrappy, and her hair managed to make frizz look cool. We'd all been friends since the 7th grade musical. Jane was in the orchestra, Danny was the lead, and I happily knocked around in the pitch-black lighting booth with my clipboard and headset. It was sort of a metaphor for our lives together, when I thought about it. Danny was the beauty, front and center, lapping up the spotlight and the applause. I was the support crew, uncomfortably hiding my pudge and shyness beneath a loose t-shirt. And without Jane, neither of us had any reason to be on stage at all. We got on the bus and bumped our way home. In keeping with the rest of the day, everyone seemed sleepy and subdued. The sky continued to darken, and the wind picked up, blowing some of the newly budding flowers almost flat against the ground. Danny and I sat in weary silence, Danny texting some guy from her economics class and me watching the neighborhoods roll by. The windows were open, and the warm breeze felt good against my face. On Thursday nights, I had exactly 1 hour between the time I got off the bus and the time Mom got home with Marin. Just enough time to claim a snack and the TV, but not nearly enough to decompress to a level where I could handle Marin's excessive energy. Something about preschool amped her up, made her loud and squeaky, so she practically vibrated around the room. It was my least favorite part of the afternoon,
That space between when Mom and Marin bulldozed through the front door and when they left for Marin's dance class, leaving me to start dinner. That day, Marin tumbled into the living room, already wearing her orange and black leotard with the rhinestone collar, her face sticky from a popsicle or whatever it was they gave her at school. She hopped over to the couch and immediately began bugging me about the East Coast swing. Mom, still in her work skirt and low scuffed heels, bustled around us, mumbling things about the living room being a damn cave as she snapped on lights, making me blink and squint.
No, I don't want to. Go away, I yelled at Marin, and she went into Mom's room, where I could hear her chattering incessantly and rifling through things while Mom tried to change clothes. I ignored them, finally satisfied that it was quiet and I could watch TV in peace. Jersey? Mom called from her room, and I pretended I didn't hear her because I didn't want to get up. A few seconds later, she came into the living room, pulling her earring out, her pantyhose draped over one arm, her toes looking red and taxed against the carpet.
Jersey? Huh? Didn't you hear me calling you?
No. A look of annoyance flitted over her face as she reached to pull the earring out of her other ear.
Did you put the towels in the wash?
No, I forgot, I said.
I'll get them in a minute.
This time the annoyance crossed her face full force.
They need to get done. I want them in the dryer before I get back.
Okay, I mumbled.
And start dinner,
she continued, heading back toward her room.
I will.
And take the dishes out of the dishwasher, she called from her bedroom.
I will!
God! I called back. I was 10 when Mom married Ronnie, but until then it had always been just Mom and me. My alcoholic dad had walked out on us when I was barely a year old. According to my mom, he was constantly in and out of jail for crimes that usually started with the word drunk. He was hardly a parent to begin with, and most of the time she felt like she was raising two kids, not one. Still, she stuck it out because she thought they were in love. But one night he left and never came back. She tried to find him, she said, but it was as if he'd disappeared from the face of the earth. Every time I asked about him, she told me that if he was still alive, he didn't want to be found, at least not by us. I hadn't seen him since I was a toddler. I couldn't remember what he looked like. And because Mom's parents were control freaks who wrote her off when she got pregnant with me, I had never seen them either. I didn't even know where they lived. I only knew they didn't live in Elizabeth. 10 years of being the Mom and Me duo meant a lot of chores fell on my shoulders. Mom needed help, and I didn't mind giving it most of the time because she worked really hard. And though I might not always have had the best stuff for the most expensive vacations, I had the things I needed. And I loved my mom. But after Mom married Ronnie and had Marin, the chores for two turned into chores for four, and that got old. Sometimes it seemed Mom was constantly reminding me of the stuff I needed to get done. Mom and Marin continued rushing around, Marin prancing in and out of the living room, singing, humming, and I pressed the back of my head harder into the throw pillow and wished they would get going already and leave me alone. Eventually, Mom came into the living room, calling for Marin to go to the bathroom and shoving her feet into the black flat she'd left next to the front door. She'd changed into jeans and a t-shirt and was digging through her purse.
Okay, we're going to dance class, she said absently. Be back in an hour or so.
Okay, I said, bored, uninterested, ready for them to leave. Marin raced into the living room, her own purse draped over her arm, looking like a miniature version of Mom. In truth, it was Mom's old purse, an ugly black thing Mom had given to Marin after she got tired of it. Marin adored it, carried it everywhere, stuffing it with her most prized possessions.
No, leave that here, Mom said, pushing open the screen door with her shoulder.
But I want to take it, Marin argued.
No, you'll forget it like last time, and I don't want to have to make another return trip to Miss Janice's. Leave it here.
No!
Marin cried, getting her meltdown voice on. Mom gave her the no-nonsense look I recognized all too well.
You're going to be late, and then you'll miss the hello dance, she warned.
Marin, head down and shoulders droopy, placed the purse on the floor next to the door and followed Mom out onto the porch,
her glittery little shoes looking dull and lifeless under the cloudy sky.
"Don't forget the laundry," Mom said on her way out.
"I know," I sing-songed back sarcastically, rolling my eyes.
I thought I knew so much.
Knew there was laundry to be done. Knew when Mom and Marin would come home. Knew how the rest of the evening was going to go. But I didn't know anything. I had no idea.
Chapter 2. After Mom and Marin left, I got up and put the towels in the washing machine. It had gotten so dark, I had to turn on the overhead light to see what I was doing. The cloud cover almost made it feel like nighttime. I poured soap over the towels, thinking once again how it seemed like everything had changed when Mom married Ronnie. I'd gone from being the most important thing in her life to being one of the most important things in her life. Sounds like the same thing, but it isn't. Sharing the spotlight gets kind of crowded sometimes, especially when you were used to having so much space in it before. When Mom got pregnant, I was excited. Being an only child could get lonely, and I'd always envied my friends who had siblings. I didn't think 10 years was that much difference, really. I thought Marin would look up to me and I could teach her all kinds of things and be like her hero or something. But what I hadn't banked on was that there would be a lot of years where she would be a baby. The baby. The center of everything. And even though I knew I was that once, too, it still sucked when it was her turn. Which made me feel like a jerk. What kind of horrible person resented her little sister for something she couldn't even control? After I got the laundry started, I went into the kitchen and pulled out the hamburger meat and a skillet. I crumbled the burger into the skillet and turned on the stove, then wandered back toward the living room to watch some more TV while I waited for the meat to start cooking. On the way, I grabbed my backpack off the kitchen table, dug my reading homework out of it,
hint, hint, ladies and gentlemen,
and carried it to the couch with me. But as I turned on the lamp next to the couch and sat down, the TV station switched to the news. A meteorologist standing in front of a giant map with a radar image on it, a bright red patch moving across the screen in jumps and fits. I picked up my book and started reading, waiting for him to finish talking and get back to the show. Seemed like every time a raindrop or snowflake fell anywhere near Elizabeth, the weather forecasters acted like the end of the world was coming. I read, tuning in and out of what he was saying, catching bits and pieces.
System that is producing tornadoes in Clay County is moving east at approximately. Seems to be picking up speed. Had 2 reported touchdowns. Headed toward... will hit Elizabeth at 5:16.
I heard the meat start to sizzle in the kitchen and put down my book. Rain or shine, we still had to eat. As soon as I picked up the spatula, the siren started. I paused. My hand in the air, and listened. One of the sirens was in a field behind my old elementary school, 2 blocks away from our house, so it was loud. When I was a kid, the tornado sirens used to freak me out. They used to freak all of us out, and the teachers were always having to tell us to calm down. Kids would be crying, holding their palms over their ears and asking for their moms, and the teachers would be standing at the front of the room with their hands up in the air, shouting to be heard over us and the sirens, reminding us that they were only monthly tests and there was no emergency. By 5th grade, we were all cool about it. Oh, it's the tornado sirens, no big deal. And by middle school, we barely even noticed the sirens at all. I leaned back and glanced into the living room, where the meteorologist was still standing in front of the Doppler photo, still pointing and talking, a sheaf of papers in his right hand. I sighed, looking back at the half-cooked meat. I didn't want to turn it off only to have it be another false alarm and have dinner ruined and Mom pissed. But technically, we were under a tornado warning. And even though there was a warning about every 3rd week in Elizabeth, we were supposed to take it seriously each time and go downstairs. Hardly anyone ever did, though. Midwest weather was crazy, after all, and half the time too crazy to really predict. We'd all learned to ignore the warnings. Most of them never turned out to be anything anyway. I moved over to the kitchen sink and peered out the window. I could see wind pushing the swings on our neighbor's swing set.
The rings danced merrily, and the slide quivered. Colby, who'd lived next door to me since we were toddlers, was standing outside on his back porch, hands in his pockets, gazing up into the sky, his hair whipping around so that I could see his scalp with each gust. Colby always did this when the weather turned bad. A lot of people did, actually. They wanted the chance to see a funnel cloud for themselves, should one ever appear. I reached up and knocked on the window. He didn't hear me. I knocked again, louder, and he turned, pulled a hand out of his pocket, and waved. I waved back. He was peering out over Church Street, where plenty of cars were creeping along with their headlights on. Rush hour was starting and everyone was coming home, like normal. It wasn't even raining. I went back to the stove, still holding the spatula, and decided to wait until it started to rain or do something more serious than just look nasty. But I had no more than touched the meat with the spatula when the power went out, bathing me in darkness and that blatting of the emergency sirens, which went on and on, so loud I only barely heard the buzz of the blinds in the laundry room as the wind pressed against the house, harder and harder. "Great," I said aloud. "I guess we'll have McDonald's for dinner then." I put the spatula down and turned off the stove, then grabbed my backpack, stuffing my book inside, and headed for the basement, aka Ronnie's room. The basement wasn't a terrible place to kill time, especially since Ronnie had put a pool table, a couch, and a mini fridge down there. Every so often, he'd have some friends over, and they'd all disappear downstairs, and we could hear pool balls cracking up against one another and smell the cigarette smoke as it drifted up through the living room carpet. He didn't love us hanging out in his space, but tonight I had no choice. I rummaged around on Ronnie's work table and found a flashlight, then clicked it on. It worked. Giving a quick glance to the one small window, it was still dark and windy, I flopped down on the couch and opened my book. My phone buzzed and I pulled it out of my pocket.
"Hey, Danny, I guess it's a good time to catch up on some reading for tomorrow's quiz,"
I said in my Miss Soper impression.
"Are you downstairs?"
Danny's voice was worried, thin.
"Yep. Waste of time, but since the power's out, I have nothing better to do, I guess."
"My mom said a tornado touched down on M Highway. She said it's headed right toward us. She wanted me to make sure you knew."
M Highway was closer than I wanted it to be, and that news startled me a little, but it was still the country out there. It seemed like tornadoes were touching down on those country highways all the time.
"Yeah, I heard the sirens. I'm good," I said, though I realized that my voice might have sounded a bit thin, too.
"Is Jane still at school?"
Danny asked.
"I haven't heard from her," I said. "I can text her."
"I already did. She didn't answer."
"They were probably playing, and she didn't hear her phone."
"Plus," I added inside my head, "the orchestra room is in the basement anyway. She's fine."
"I'll try her.
Colby is standing outside right now." Danny made a noise into the phone.
"I'm not surprised. He's nuts. He's not going to be happy until he gets carried away in a tornado."
"It's not even raining out there."
"Still, he's crazy.
One touchdown on M Highway."
"I know. Call me if you talk to Jane."
"Okay." I hung up and sent Jane a quick text. The siren stopped for a minute, and I would have thought maybe the storm was passing, but it had gotten even darker outside, and then they started up again. I chewed my lip, held my phone in my lap for a few seconds, then called Mom.
"Jersey!" she shouted into the phone. The noise around her was even louder. Emergency horns, police sirens, and the loud chatter and crying of little girls. "Jersey?
Danny's mom said a tornado was on M Highway," I said.
"I can't hear her," I heard my mom say, and another woman's voice close by said something about more touchdowns.
"Jersey!"
Mom repeated.
"I'm here," I shouted. "Hello, can you hear me?"
"Jersey, I can't hear you. If you can hear me, go to the basement, okay?" she yelled.
"I am,"
I said, but I knew she couldn't hear what I was saying, and fear really began to creep into my stomach. She sounded afraid. Mom never sounded afraid, ever.
She never wavered. She was always strong. Even when I fell off the monkey bars in second grade and landed straight on my neck and had to go in an ambulance to the hospital. Mom had simply sat next to me in the ambulance, talking in a low, steady voice. One that calmed me.
Mom? Hello? You there? Everybody this way! She shouted, her voice sounding farther away from the phone, like maybe she was holding it at her side and had forgotten that it was on.
There was a bustling noise, and the crying and talking got louder and more jumbled and then was overtaken by a rumbling sound.
Mom?
I said, but she didn't answer. I could hear her shouting,
"Get your heads down! Get your heads down!"
and lots of screaming and crying. I thought I might have heard glass breaking. And then I heard nothing but the drone of the sirens outside my window. Chapter 3.
Mom? Mom!
I kept yelling into the phone, even though I knew the connection had been lost. I tried to call again, but the line wouldn't connect. I realized that my hands were shaking and my fingers didn't want to work around the phone's keypad anymore. I dropped it twice and then tried to call Ronnie, but that call wouldn't go through either. The sirens screeched one last time and then abruptly stopped, and I could hear wild clicking against the window. Hail. And something else. Something louder. Thumps and thuds and scrapes against the house, like larger items were slamming up against it. Metallic clangs and broken sounds. For a moment, I sat there, frozen on the couch. I thought I heard what sounded like a train rumbling down our street. And I remembered one time in fourth grade when our teacher read us a book that described the sound of a tornado as being something like the sound of a locomotive. I hadn't believed it at the time. It didn't make sense that a tornado could sound like anything but blowing wind, but there it was, the sound of a train passing. I held my breath in frightened anticipation. The moment stretched around me, the noise getting louder and then muting as my ears began popping, and I gripped my cell phone like I was holding onto the side of a cliff. I tried to be still so I could listen. Maybe I was mistaken. Maybe it was my imagination and there was no train sound out there. I was hearing what I was scared to hear. But then something really huge hit the house. I heard the tinkling of glass breaking upstairs on the other end of the house, over where Marin's bedroom was. A loud, metallic grating noise seared the air outside as something was pushed down the street. I only had seconds to think about Colby, to wonder if he was still out there, when the basement window suddenly shattered, ushering in an enormous roar of noise. I screamed, my voice getting lost in the din. I instinctively covered my head and then scrambled under the pool table, pulling my backpack and cell phone with me. Noise blasted in, and I rolled up in a ball, cradling my head with my arms. I squeezed my eyes shut. There were great loud creaks and bangs, glass shattering and shattering and shattering. Thunks as things spun and flew and hit walls. Groans and wooden popping sounds as walls gave. Bricks tumbled. Crunching thuds as heavy building materials hit the floors. I heard these things happening, but it was unclear where exactly they were happening. Was it in the basement? Upstairs? Down the street? Space and time were distorted, and even the most basic things like direction didn't make sense. Wind whipped the hem of my shirt and pulled at my hair, and I felt out in the open, as if the tornado had somehow gotten into the basement. Small items blasted across the floor and battered me. I opened my eyes and saw one of Ronnie's work boots thud against my side. Papers whipped around me, bending over my arms. A wall calendar screamed past. An empty milk crate, which had spilled its contents, tumbled up against my shins. An ashtray knocked me in the back of the head, making me cry out and inch my fingers over to where it had hit, feeling the warmth and wetness I was sure was blood. The pool table spun half a circle and came to rest again. It felt like a never-ending stream of chaos, like my whole world was being shaken and tossed and torn apart and like it would never stop, like I would be stuck in this terror forever. I was confused, and my arms, legs, back, and head stung. I coiled into myself, gripping my head and crying, half sobbing, half shrieking. I don't know how long I stayed that way before I realized it was over. Chapter 4. When I opened my eyes, at first I stayed in my safety position. I could hear rain now, pelting the ground, only the ground seemed very close. It was still dark, still windy, but had already lightened up some since the tornado had passed. At last I forced myself to let go of my head and felt around for my cell phone. It was lodged between my backpack and my stomach, and I pulled it out, my fingers white and shaky as I clung to it. I tried to call Mom. No connection. I tried Ronnie. Same. 911. Nothing. I tried Jane, Danny, everyone I could think of. I was getting no bars, no cell service. I lay there for a few more minutes, trying to catch my breath and quell my panicked sobbing. My arms and legs felt tingly from adrenaline and fear. I listened. I could hear talking and loud cries and car alarms bleating. A stuck police siren, a plea for help, and off in the distance, just maybe, the growling chug of the funnel cloud moving on. Growing up, we were taught over and over again what steps to take in case of an approaching tornado. Listen for sirens, go to your basement or cellar or a closet in the center of your house, duck and cover, wait it out. We had drills twice a year, every year, in school. We talked about it in class. We talked about it at home. The newscasters reminded us. We went to the basement. We practiced, practiced, practiced. But we'd never, not once, discussed what to do after. I think we never thought there would be an after like this one. It seemed like forever before the rain and wind stopped. It was still gray around me. But the sky had lightened up enough that I could see fine without the flashlight, which I'd dropped in my scramble to the pool table. Colby. I would go get Colby, see if he could call my mom from his phone. Slowly I uncurled myself and, after a moment of hesitation, slid out from under the table and sat up. At the opposite end of the basement, where Ronnie's workbench normally sat, there was no ceiling. The floor I had been standing on while rummaging for a flashlight just 15 minutes before was now buried in a dusty pile of rubble, what used to be our kitchen. Except the table was gone, and the walls were gone, and the plates had all fallen out of their cabinets, which were also gone, and now lay in a heap on the concrete basement floor. What was worse, I could see sky where the kitchen used to be. Wires and broken pipes jutted out here and there. Water gushed from somewhere. "Oh my God," I said, pulling myself up to standing, unsure whether my wobbly legs would keep me that way. "Oh my God." I took a few steps toward the rubble. The closer I got, the more sky I could see. The kitchen walls. They were gone. Completely and totally gone. I could have walked right up the rubble pile to the outside if I'd wanted to, but the sight of my broken kitchen was so foreign, the bare and jutting wires so frightening, I couldn't make myself approach it. The basement stairs were still standing, and for some reason walking up them and through the basement door into the house seemed like the right thing to do, so I made my way over to them, a part of me hoping that maybe if I went up the stairs, the rest of the house wouldn't be as bad as the kitchen looked. The couch had been pulled to the rubble and turned up on its side. There were clothes strewn everywhere. I glanced down at my hands, my fingers streaked with dried blood, my right hand wrapped around my useless cell phone. I stuffed the phone into my pocket and reached around to the back of my head again. It was sticky and my hair felt kind of matted, but it didn't really hurt or anything and it wasn't gushing blood, so I ignored it, trying to keep things in perspective. It was just a cut. It could wait until Mom got home. Everything would be fine once she got here. I crept forward, edging around things that didn't belong there. A hunk of Venetian blinds, a DVD, a carpet of wet papers, a dog leash, a swing from Colby's little sister's swing set, the ends of the chain twisted and broken as if chewed up by a giant monster. Slowly, I crept up the stairs and pushed on the door, which would only open a little before it was stopped by something wedged against it.
I tried leaning into the door and pushing harder, but it wouldn't budge, so I sucked in my stomach and squeezed through the opening. I stepped into the room, my dried, bloody hand flying up to my mouth. Had I not known I was standing in my living room, I never would have guessed this was my house. The roof was completely missing. The whole thing, no holes or tears, gone. Some of the outside walls were also missing, and the remaining walls were in perilously bad condition. One was leaning outward, the window blown and the frame hanging by a corner. Farther away, where the living room and the kitchen normally met, the house just ended. I knew from what I'd seen downstairs that much of it had toppled in on itself, but I hadn't been prepared for how gone it was. Even the stove was missing. Not moved, but completely absent, nowhere in sight. I couldn't make it to my room. I couldn't even really tell where my room was, and for a few minutes I stood dumbly in the basement doorway, my hand over my mouth, my eyes wide, my heart beating so fast I thought I might throw up, trying to take everything in. I'd seen photos of houses destroyed by tornadoes before, but never had I seen anything like it in real life. The destruction was complete and terrible. Outside. I needed to go outside and see if anyone else's house had gotten hit. I needed to find help, to find Mom, to find someone who could take me to her so I could break it to her how bad the house was damaged and let her know I was okay. I made my way to the front door, which was oddly still there, still on its hinges, though it was hanging on to a partial wall. It took me several minutes of clawing at scraps of wood and climbing over debris to get to the door, treading carefully in my bare feet, wishing I'd been wearing shoes when the tornado hit, or at least had brought a pair down to the basement with me. I cut my hand on glass twice, more blood seeping out and mixing with the dried blood and grime already there. I wiped it on my jeans and kept going, trying to force down the frantic feeling welling inside me as I heard more crying and voices outside. As I took a final step toward the door, my foot sank into something soft and cold. It was Marin's purse, the one Mom had made her leave at home. I pulled it out of the rubble, then held it up and studied it. Other than being dirty and dusty and a little bit wet, it looked fine. I set it on top of a bent kitchen chair next to me for safekeeping. Marin would want her purse when she got back. Finally, I wrenched the door open and immediately went breathless, as if I'd had the wind knocked out of me. I saw little lights dance before my eyes and my lips felt tingly. For a shaky moment, I thought I might pass out. It hadn't been just our house. It had been everyone's houses. There was no street. Just piles upon piles of scraps and glass and broken furniture and wood and trash. I leaned back against the remaining wall of my house, but it groaned under my weight, and I stood up again quickly. I couldn't get my breath. I wanted my mom, or Ronnie, somebody to hold me up. Several neighbors were standing in the street in various poses of upset. Mr. Klingbeil stood with his hands on his hips, staring at what used to be his house and shaking his head. Mrs. Fay was locked in an embrace with Mrs. Chamberlain. They were both weeping loudly. Some of the little kids were crouching in the street, their faces looking curious and half-excited as they picked up branches and toys and bricks, but also very somber, like even they understood that this was bad, bad, bad. A couple of people were bent at the waist, mucking through the rubble of their houses, picking up little busted pieces of this and that and discarding them again. I could see movement where our road normally connected with Church Street. A trickle of people were trudging along, looking shocked and lost. Off in the distance, I could hear the wailing of sirens, emergency vehicles, but nothing nearby. How could they get to us, I wondered. There was no street to drive on. It was impossible to find it under all the rubble. One man fell and a woman near him dropped to his side, pushing on his shoulder and yelling out, "Help! Anyone, please!" But the people kept walking around them, looking dazed and wounded. Finally, a man stopped and after a few minutes helped her get the fallen man to his feet. Together they trudged along, the man between them, his arms slung around their necks.
"Holy shit," I heard.
Colby was pulling himself through his basement window, which appeared to be the only opening to the basement at all. Unlike my house, which still had that one wall standing, Colby's house had been completely razed to the ground.
"Holy shit."
And then he yelled it.
"Holy shit!"
His little sister scrambled out the window behind him, silently taking in the scene as I'd done, her feet bare, her legs and feet smudged with dirt.
"You okay, Jersey?"
he shouted, and I could feel my head nodding, but I still wasn't entirely sure I wasn't going to pass out, so the movement felt very slow and fluid. He turned and dropped to his knees, sticking his head back through the basement window, and then came out again, holding his mom under her arms and tugging her. She tumbled outside and sat where she landed, her hands going to her cheeks.
"Oh, dear Lord,"
I heard her say. And then she began praying.
"Thank you, Jesus, for keeping us alive. Thank you, dear Jesus, for saving us."
Colby started in my direction.
"You should get away from that wall,"
he said, climbing across boards to get to me. He stepped on a baby rattle, cracking it. I stared at it, wondering where it might have come from and what had happened to the baby it belonged to.
"Jersey? Hey, Jersey, you okay?"
I nodded again, but the image of a baby flying through the air, caught in the eye of a monster tornado, was about all I could take, and I felt myself starting to go down.
"Whoa, whoa!"
Colby said, and he lunged up to the porch to grab my shoulders and keep me upright.
"Any help over here?"
he called out. "I'm okay," I mumbled. "I just need to sit down."
"You're bleeding,"
he said, maneuvering so he was next to me, his arm around both of my shoulders. He walked me off the porch and toward where our front yard used to be. Colby and I had played more games of wiffle ball on that front yard than I could count. Now that seemed like forever ago.
"I'm okay,"
I mumbled again, but when Colby eased me toward a cinder block on the ground, I was glad to be sitting.
"You're bleeding,"
he repeated.
"Where are you hurt?"
I reached up to the back of my head again. It seemed dry now.
"An ashtray hit me," I said, "but I think it's just a cut."
I heard his mother calling out to someone else, asking if anyone was hurt. Colby squatted in front of me so that his face was only inches from mine.
"Where is everybody?"
he asked. And when I didn't answer, he said,
"Your mom and Ronnie? Marin."
I closed my eyes. It was easier to concentrate when I wasn't looking at the wasted neighborhood.
"Mom and Marin are at dance class. I don't know where Ronnie is. I don't know if he was on his way home from work or..."
I trailed off, watched as Mr. Fay pointed out to Mrs. Fay a 2x4 that had been driven into the side of their house and was sticking out like a dart. Mrs. Fay snapped a photo of it with her phone.
"The whole street is gone."
He stood up and peered down Church Street, with its trickle of refugees heading away from the destruction.
"I know,"
he said.
"It's just... holy cow."
"How far do you think it went?" I asked. He shook his head but didn't answer. "Colby, how far do you think it went?"
"I don't know," he said, his voice sounding flat and croaky. "Looks like far."
"Do you think..." I started, but I trailed off, afraid to finish my question, afraid that the answer would be no. "Do you think Mom will be able to get to me?" Chapter 5. The next few hours went by in a blur. Some of the men were going house to house, cocking their heads and listening for cries for help under the rubble. Every time they heard even the tiniest noise, the mew of a cat, or the wooden click of a board settling, or anything that might have sounded like a whimper, they fell on it, down on their knees, ripping things apart with their hands, their faces dripping with sweat and determination. A yell went up every time a hole to a basement was found, an expectant and grateful face peering up out of it. And then they found Mrs. Dempsey. Too fragile to make it to her basement, the old lady had cowered in her bathtub to ride out the storm. She'd even brought some pillows in with her. They found her there, pillows still surrounding her, but a central air unit crushing the top half of her body. They pulled the air conditioner off of her, and Mrs. Fay found a shower curtain, and they draped it over Mrs. Dempsey's body. After that, the mood got very somber, and people started wondering aloud when the emergency vehicles were going to come help us. We could still hear them braying and warbling in the distance, but the sounds weren't getting any closer. We thought we even heard the staccato bark of someone talking through a PA system or a megaphone, but none of us could make out the words. It was all very muffled and so very far away. Why were they so far away? The rescue efforts got slower. People started saying they were thirsty or tired and spent more time sitting or picking through their own things half-heartedly. I had no doubt that after all that digging, the men were thirsty. But I had a theory that the new focus on preventing dehydration was a way of not admitting that they were really afraid of finding another dead body. Only the next time it might be a toddler, or a teenager, or someone they'd had lunch with just last week. I stayed on my cinder block watching them. Every so often I would try my cell phone again, wait for it to ring, which it never did, peer down the street for Mom's car, which never turned the corner. Colby's shadow fell over me. "We're going for a walk. You want to come?" he asked, touching me lightly on the shoulder. I shook my head, not looking up. He waited a moment. "You sure? We want to see how bad the damage is and see where everybody's going." I saw his shadow gesture toward Church Street, but again I shook my head. "Will you be okay by yourself?" he asked, shuffling the toe of his shoe awkwardly against the cinder block I sat on. "I can stay." "No," I said. "Go ahead, I'm fine. It's just, if I'm not here when Mom gets back, she's going to freak out." But even I wasn't sure how honest that statement was. Part of me knew I was staying because I was afraid to see how far the damage went. I didn't want to know why a steady stream of people continued to trickle down Church Street. After he left, I tried not to let my mind wander. Tried not to think about the small things I'd lost in the tornado, especially not with Mrs. Dempsey covered by a shower curtain a couple houses down. But I couldn't help myself. My clothes, my earrings, my music. Granted, I didn't have trendy clothes or expensive earrings, but if it had all blown away, I had nothing. Even a few cheap somethings is better than nothing. How much of Mom's stuff was gone? How much of all of our stuff was gone, and how long would it be before we got it back? I looked down at my feet and noticed that one was resting on a photo. I picked it up, pulled it out of the grime, and studied it. I wondered where our photos had gone. If our past would end up under a stranger's foot, would it be tossed in the garbage? The thought left me cold. It seemed impossible to still have a past if your memories were resting beneath blackened banana peels in a landfill. I stared at that photo for a long, long time. A family, dressed in matching t-shirts and jeans, stood by a tree. The little boy up front mugged for the camera. He was smiling so hard around gaps of missing teeth, his eyes were pushed shut. His mom's hands were on his shoulders protectively. An older sister with long, straight hair smiled sweetly with her dad's arm around her waist. A whole happy family. I wondered if the tornado had hit them, too. If it had done to their house, what it had done to ours. I wondered where their street was. Where that tree was. A jolt went through me and I stood up. The trees. For the first time, I noticed that they were gone. Not just a few broken or blown over here or there, which happened pretty regularly during spring storms in Elizabeth. They were gone. Big holes where some had been. Snapped off trunks. Stripped branches. Our once tree-lined street had been robbed of all things green. I turned in circles, craning my neck to see around and above the mounds of boards and broken houses. I couldn't see any trees. I dropped the photo back onto the mountain of junk and plopped down again. The afternoon stretched on, and then evening began to set in. My stomach started to twist with hunger, and I idly thought about the hamburger I'd left in the pan on the stove when the storm hit. I wondered what we'd do for dinner, and the thought prompted me to try my cell phone again. Still no service. Still no Mom. Colby and his mom and sister came back, their figures shadowy under the graying sky of evening combined with what looked like another approaching thunderstorm. Slowly, people who'd stayed behind crawled out of the rubble to greet them, dropping whatever bricks or boards or old appliances they were holding, curiosity winning out on their faces. I got up and walked toward them, too.
"Gone,"
Colby was saying when I reached them. He was out of breath, his eyes bright and cheeks gritty.
"Gone,"
he repeated. He shook his head. His sister clutched the hem of her mom's shirt.
"We walked at least a mile,"
his mom said, her voice loud and take charge. The emergency sirens had finally stopped, leaving us in a blanket of confused silence.
"Everywhere it looks like this, and there's people..."
She paused, her jowls trembling.
"Dear Jesus, please be with those people," she whispered.
"Are the ambulances?"
Mrs. Fay asked, but tapered off when Colby shook his head.
"No way they can get to us. The streets are covered, like this one. The houses are gone, and it looks like it goes on forever. I can't even see Bending Oaks. It's gone, too. A whole school."
Bending Oaks was the junior high Colby and I went to. It was a good 3 miles away, but it sat atop a hill, so it was visible from almost anywhere in Elizabeth. I had a hard time wrapping my head around what the hill would look like without the big building silhouetted in the sun.
When I tuned in again, Colby was saying, "A 2x4 through his leg. He was trying to drag himself out of his house, and his neighbor found a wheelbarrow. But they said the hospital's been hit, too, so nobody knows where to go. Nobody's ever seen anything like this."
I thought back to all the people I'd seen walking along Church Street, about the man who had collapsed. They'd been trying to make their way to help, but what if there was no help? How far would they have to go before they found it?
"Dear Jesus, please be with us in our time of sorrow and need,"
Colby's mother had begun again, her eyes shut tight, her palms facing upward. Colby glanced at her, seemed to consider saying more, but thought better of it, and hung his head. A couple people gathered around his mom and muttered, "Amen," every so often, listening as her prayer tumbled through our devastated portion of the street. The hospital was at least 5 miles in the opposite direction. If it had been hit, and Bending Oaks had been hit, that meant this tornado had reached in and swept away a huge chunk of Elizabeth. It also meant that Marin's dance studio had been right in the tornado's path. Nobody knew what to do. We stood gathered around Colby and his mom and sister for a long time, and more neighbors joined us one by one. Someone's son had been sucked right out of his bedroom while he rummaged for a weather radio. Someone hadn't heard from her husband, who was driving home from work. Someone wondered if his wife, a nurse working a rotation in the PICU, was okay. Someone had heard pounding and yells coming from beneath a car and was sure there were still neighbors trapped inside their homes. And speaking of homes, nobody had one anymore. Where would we go? What would we do? That became our mantra. What are we going to do? Then the sky opened up and raindrops tumbled onto our arms and our cheeks and pattered against the boards we stood on, releasing an earthy smell. And we had no trees to huddle under. We had no umbrellas. Our only shower curtain was covering poor Mrs. Dempsey. So we stood in the rain, squinting against it.